Bailey versus Kent School District. Please come forward, we'll hear that case next.
May it please the court, I'm Susan Mindenbergs, and I represent Ann Bailey in her case against the Kent School District.
Do you want to reserve any time for rebuttal?
2 minutes, please, Your Honor. Ms. Bailey is seeking reversal of the summary judgment of her claims of hostile work environment, retaliation, and violation of the Family Medical Leave Act. Ms. Bailey was a highly valued curricular leader of special education at Kent School District, Kent Meridian High School. Her efforts to advocate on behalf of disabled students of color led to hostility and ultimately retaliation in the workplace. And I'd like to focus first on the retaliation claim.
Could I ask you,
yes, Your Honor.
Jumping ahead to the FMLA claim, if we were to agree with you that there was an FMLA violation, what remedy are you asking for? Do you have to prove damages, or does damages naturally flow from a violation?
Well, now the damages would be from the negative consequences, and the negative consequences in the FMLA violation are the constructive discharge, so damages would occur.
You didn't claim a constructive discharge as an independent basis in any of your, you had an original complaint and an amended complaint. I didn't see a constructive discharge.
Right. And, Your Honor, constructive discharge is not an independent cause of action and doesn't need to be pled independently. But in the complaint itself, it does articulate that she left her employment because of the hostility in the workplace and at the behest of her medical care provider.
So you're saying you'd have to put on proof of damages that flow from an FMLA violation. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, from the negative consequences. That's right, Your Honor. With regard to the retaliation claim, the trial court found that Ms. Bailey did not engage in any protected activity cognizable under RCW 49-6210. But to the contrary, she sought an accommodation for her disability in August of 2012. And then in November of 2012, she filed an EEOC charge of discrimination. In November and December of 2012, her lawyer contacted the school district.
So there were two EEOC claims. There was one against the district, and she also filed one against her union. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Which one are you claiming is the
protected activity?
Yes.
Yes. The one against the school district.
Not against the union?
No. No.
She withdrew that claim. Is that right? EEOC claim against the union.
You don't really withdraw an EEOC charge, but she didn't pursue it. So even if the court finds that the advocacy on behalf of the disabled students is not protected activity, clearly the actions in August, November, and December are protected activity. Next, the trial court found that Ms. Bailey didn't suffer any adverse consequences, and basically the court said, well, the district offered her a substitute position, so that eviscerated the adverse consequence prong of retaliation. But adverse employment action means a material change in employment status, such as, quote, a reassignment with significantly different responsibilities. And that's found in Burlington versus White, 547 U.S. 53.
Is there a question of fact as to whether or not, under the circumstances, because apparently it's undisputed that the timing with which she wanted to come back and that arrangements had already been made to cover her work while she was off on medical leave. Will those facts have any bearing on whether there was an adverse action by the school district? In other words, bringing her back, they didn't bring her back at the same job as what she wanted, which was partially the coordinator, curriculum coordinator, and then teaching. They had a substitute position available to her.
Well, they said that she should report to the Human Resources Department to get a substitute position somewhere in the school district. And what the Human Resource, I'm not sure I'm directing my question specifically to, my answer specifically to your question. The problem was that they didn't offer her an equivalent job, so that violates the Family Medical Leave Act.
They also established that they couldn't because your client indicated she'd be gone for a certain period of time, and that changed a couple of times, too. But reassigning kids and teachers and allocating those types of resources, they were able to establish undisputed evidence that it would be extremely disruptive, not only to kids that weren't challenged by disabilities and mainstreaming them, but would certainly be harmful to kids that are challenged and upon which the individual educational program was to be applied in any particular class.
And Ms. Bailey appreciates that. In November of 2012, when she was going to return, she and the principal discussed what she would do in the interim because her classes couldn't have been reconstituted within several weeks.
Well, she agreed that it was impossible to reconstitute.
Absolutely. And what she and the principal decided in November of 2012, before she filed the EEOC charge, was that she would return and she would do IEPs for other teachers who were behind in their IEPs. There is an enormous amount of paperwork that special education teachers have to do.
Agreement for just until the next semester started, or that was going to be her new permanent position?
Well, what I'm saying is in November, she agreed with the principal that that's what she would be doing. And then in January...
Doing for what period of time?
Well, in November, it would have been for a couple of weeks. In January, it would have been until the next semester started, and then her classes would have been reconstituted. But with regard to the adverse consequences, clearly the constructive discharge is sort of the ultimate adverse consequence. And constructive discharge is an adverse consequence, according to the court in Crownover versus the State Department of Transportation. And what the court said there was, well, clearly constructive discharge is an adverse consequence, but the trial court just completely ignored that consequence for Ms. Bailey. In Crownover, the court said, well, what we need to do is look to see whether the resignations were voluntary or involuntary. And here, Ms. Bailey's resignation was not voluntary. It was involuntary, and she was merely following the advice of her medical provider. The last thing that the trial court did in the retaliation claim that was in violation of the precedent was that the court said that Ms. Bailey failed to disprove Kent's claims of legitimate reasons for not allowing her to return to work. But this is the essence of the holding in Scrivener versus Clark College. An employee does not need to disprove each of the employer's articulated reasons to satisfy the pretext burden of production.
What class are you alleging she's a member of?
For purposes of the retaliation claim, she is in a protected class because of her protected activity in August 2012, asking for an accommodation for her EEOC charge in November of 2012.
Since that's a retaliation claim, isn't it?
That is the claim that I have been describing, Your Honor, the retaliation claim. I didn't get to the hostile work environment claim. We didn't get an opportunity to do that. That her protected activity there is advocating on behalf of disabled students. It's different for the retaliation claim, however.
You'll have 2 minutes.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. Jill Smith here on behalf of Kent School District, defending a motion for summary judgment that was, at its core, brought on a failure to accommodate case. It's important for this court to get the bigger context of the complaints, and you have them and obviously have looked at them. This was a...
Allege a employment discrimination case based on disability, right?
The way I understand the pleadings, plaintiff pled that within a hostile work environment claim. And that's part of, I think, the confusion that you were just discussing with counsel. The claim at its core is I can't teach anymore, and I can't teach because of a particular coworker who's made life rough on me. That led to a disability, which led to some time off, which ultimately led to one request. I need an accommodation, and the only one I'll accept is for you to create a new position for me as an administrator.
What makes it difficult is that she didn't plead a disability claim. So we've got a bit of a hybrid here, and it makes it hard to plug in the correct legal analysis because had she pled a disability claim, she doesn't get to require the employer as a reasonable accommodation to create a new job for her.
Correct.
And maybe that's the reason why it wasn't pled, because I know that she wanted a non-teaching job.
Right.
And Berenger said, we can't create a new job for you. We don't have the budget and so forth.
And would have loved to. She is a highly valued employee. No dispute about that. The pleading problem does lead to an analysis quandary because the elements of the claims we are looking at, there are missing pieces throughout. And that's what our judge at the trial court level found, is that for each of the three remaining claims, the retaliation, hostile work environment, and FMLA, there's at least one element on which the proof failed. So I'd like to structure my argument in terms of the three claims that we do have, and I understand, like you're noting, that they are hybrid. As to the what gets me into a protected class, like you just asked, plaintiff's answer very clearly today was, because I complained about treatment of special ed students. And so where you start in the record is the clerk's papers 60 through 94. And in those 30-some pages, it is absolutely crystal clear what the plaintiff's beef with Tabitha Browning was. It had nothing to do with how Browning treated students of color. In 60 through 94, you have 6 years of emails about how Browning treated plaintiff. And if there's no other way to read them. It's a 30-page read. I'd suggest that the court start there. When you get to June 2012, you do get an 11-page letter.
She didn't mention anything in her 2011 letter.
Correct.
About discrimination, right?
That's right. And
that's the first time she proposed this new job.
Exactly.
Okay.
And she already wanted it for herself, although she testified. I just meant generally it's a good idea, but the letter ends with her qualifications for the position she's proposed. You get to June 2012, and there is a letter. In 12 pages, there are two sentences. One of them provides, Browning keeps circumventing me as the authority in our department, particularly when it comes to the placement of students of color. That's one. Surprisingly, I think our trial judge actually missed that one because she found there was only one statement in the letter. I'll concede there are two. The other sentence in the letter provides, way back in 06, I went to bat for an African-American teacher, and I think way back then she began to dislike me. She's providing some context for how this dispute with Browning has turned into this incredible nightmare for her. Those are the two statements that I would argue might constitute protected activity. But what our trial judge did right is require a nexus. And there is absolutely nothing in this record, as closely as you choose to review it, that would say Dr. Berenger or anyone else who saw that letter didn't like what they saw. In fact, what they testified is, we wanted to help her with this personal dispute with Browning, which is the only way you can read the letter.
So they concede, though, that this was summary judgment.
Right.
And in a discrimination case, an employer's motive, it's a rare day when you see it written out.
Sure.
It's can be only inferred from facts that are established at trial. So generally speaking, an employer's motive is not usually proven by direct evidence.
That's correct. And so you have to look at the reasons the employer does set forth. And we are sort of stuck, because of the pleading problem, with that burden-shifting analysis. And the district here has put forth absolutely crystal clear reasons for every action it's taken with regard to Ann Bailey since the August request for that job or the June complaint about Browning. The reasons for refusing to create a new position, they pre-existed. She'd asked back a year before any of this came to light, and they denied it then.
So she alleges that one of the adverse actions was Chuck Lynn, the attorney for the school district, apparently raised his voice. She claims that was an adverse action.
I'm not aware of any legal authority that would make an attorney's conduct, even taking her allegations at their worst, a telephone contact with an attorney, with her principal in the room with her. I don't know what kind of action that would fall into that would fit any case I've ever seen. I think her piece of that is, you knew I was out because I had anxiety and stress over Browning's interactions that were conflictual. Therefore, you owed me a different or higher duty to deal with me with kid gloves. That's how I understand that adverse action argument. The gist of it, though, is that the district didn't offer the new position because it had no budget for that and had already told her that before any of her adverse or any of her protected activity arose. It didn't allow her to come back 3 weeks before the end of a term. That's a decision that the federal government has recognized in the CFRs. It's just too difficult for students to have.
She wanted to come back well before that three-week period. I know the school district has alleged that CFR within 3 weeks, but it was more than 3 weeks, wasn't it?
Well, and I want to be really clear, and I want you to, if you can, note these clerk's papers pages, because the chronology is confused in plaintiff's briefing. In November 2, Berenger emails her and says, there's no non-teaching position for you. It's going to take a few weeks to reassemble your classes, and like you ask, it was not going to be a new position for her. It was going to be, we're going to have you write IEPs until we can pull your students back together. The very same day, she files her FMLA leave to be off until February 4. And that's Clerk's Papers 496. A week later, after that, being told there is no teaching position, she files the EEOC complaint. A few weeks later, she gets a lawyer and again demands a non-teaching job. That's all she wants at that point. There is no other accommodation being requested. That's CP 506. Then, when we get to the end of December, we've had a meeting. We've all agreed she's going to come back and teach. She's understood now. I'm a teacher. I recognize you don't have to create me a new job. December 13, her attorney writes and says she's going to come back and teach three classes. And for the first time, she proposes starting right after the break. That's CP 511. She lists out a bunch of duties that the plaintiff hopes to perform between January 3rd and the start of the term. Counsel responds immediately, CP 515, we're not going to have those duties for her until the new semester break. She can come in on the 25th, and I think that's critical because that's...
Which month are we saying for the 25th?
The semester break at the end of January is 20. The new classes start January 28th.
She's first proposing she's coming back on January 4th or 3rd.
She proposed at the meeting on the 10th, I'll come back at the term. 3 days later, after the meeting, her counsel writes and says, let's make it right at the 3rd, after Christmas break. The district response is, that's not what we talked about at the meeting. We'll be ready for you at the semester break, and we can bump you up to the 25th. You can come in and start getting prepped for the 28th. Then the district writes again on the 17th of December, this is CP 519, and says, yep, you can come in on the 25th. Throughout that whole time, the operative note from Dr. Galevo, her medical provider providing the leave, still says February 4 is her first authorized return date. District office is closed for Christmas. It's a three-week break. January 2, plaintiff's attorney writes and says she'll be there tomorrow morning, expecting to perform the same or similar job duties as the end of last year. That's CP 535. In other words, I expect to be teaching tomorrow morning. That has never been on anyone's radar, that they could simply pull classes together in that sort of framework. Counsel responds immediately, same day before school, don't just show up. You can't set your own duties. That's not going to work for us. And that's CP 535.
The The causes of action aren't, they're not confused. There is a specific retaliation claim, and the retaliation basically started in August of 2012 when Ms. Bailey asked for an accommodation and asked for an accommodation for her disabling condition. She's really not, although there may have been and
what's the accommodation she's asking for then?
The accommodation that she was asking for then was a non-teaching position. And
that was a new position that had not existed in the district before her request?
That's true, Your Honor.
What case law authorizes that kind of accommodation, or let me rephrase that, requires the employer to provide that kind of accommodation?
It does not. The district was not required to provide her with it.
So
was not
retaliation to say, no, we're not going to do that?
No, it wasn't retaliation to say, no, we're not going to do that. That's not the claim, and it's not a failure to accommodate claim. It's just kind of a straightforward retaliation claim. What she's saying is when she returned to work in January of 2013, that she was offered a substitute position instead of being offered a teaching position. And
do you agree with counsel's characterization that the first time the district knew she wanted to come back immediately to teaching position on January 3rd was January 2nd?
No. On December 13th, Ms. Bailey's attorney wrote to the district and said she will be returning on January 3rd.
Did it say what she was anticipating she'd be doing?
Yes. It said she would be doing planning for the following semester.
She did a little different than saying I'm going to show up to teach?
She did never say she was going to show up to teach. She said she was going to show up to prepare to do the curricular leader duties. And then and the district responded, well, we don't have any release from her doctor. Then on December 21st, her doctor released her to return to work on January 3rd. And on December 27th, 2012, her lawyer again wrote to the district saying, okay, well, here is the release, and she is going to be returning to work on January 3rd. Thank you, Your Honor.